Most of our colleagues, they're actually working in the deep field in what we call non-family duty stations. That means they're there alone. They can't bring their families with them because it's too dangerous. I have never met such a committed group of staff people working for any organization. And I feel like the world doesn't know them, doesn't know these people who have sacrificed family life. They have been injured. They have been kidnapped. They have taken in the traumas of hundreds of people, and they're extraordinary people. And I just thought the world needs to get to know them.
When you go home at night, you think about those stories, about the face of the people you talk to, about their emotion. Sometimes you know you are the first person who have talked to them, who has received their stories. But each of those stories, somehow, you absorb them. And you just absorb. And in the middle of the night, you have nightmares because you are in those Iranian jails with them.
My name is Melissa Fleming, and I'm the spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency. You know, over the years, I have met some extraordinary people who have devoted their lives to the cause of serving refugees. What I always wonder is what drives them, what keeps them awake at night, and what keeps them going. My first guest is Vincent Cochetel. He's worked for UNHCR for over 30 years.
So I was handcuffed to a bed, handcuffed to a metallic cable that is tied to a bed, so that gives me little margin of movement around the bed. You get used to that. It was dark. The darkness was more difficult to cope with than limited freedom of movement. Darkness is something that is oppressive.
This is Awake at Night. Welcome to the podcast, Vincent.
Thank you.
You started out as a young lawyer. What happened to make you decide to go into working for refugees?
Well, when I was a kid, I grew up in blocks in a project in a small town in France. It was not a very rich area. My parents were not too well off. And all the kids in the block where I live had a foreign background. And we were going to the same school, and I could see the way society looked at them, that they were not treated exactly the same way than me. And that shocked me at a very early age, because for me, you know, I was playing soccer with them. I was I spent all my free time with them. But the way people were engaging with them was different. And these were kids of Chilean refugees, French people that had been forced to leave Algeria after the war, the liberation war there. People with other refugee backgrounds, some Portuguese refugees, some descendants of Spanish refugees, and we were all grouped in the same area. I'm not sure why my parents ended up living there, but it was quite interesting to be with those kids.
So you chose to study law?
I chose to study law, and very quickly for me, it was to be about foreigners and probably refugee. And why that? Because I don't believe that you measure how society comply with human rights by the way it treats its citizens. You measure how society comply with human rights by the way it treats its foreigners. And among its foreigners, those with no rights.
Injustice bothered you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what about your parents? And what did they encourage you, or did they want you to be a lawyer who goes and earns lots of money in the corporate field?
Well, my parents were both sport teachers, so I spent my childhood in stadiums with them. And I think my parents' life changed in 68 in France. We had long months of strikes and popular strikes. That was a defining moment for our society, when people stop living the same way than before and start raising questions. So then my parents got really involved socially, more with homeless people, quickly realized that you cannot change the big things. You don't change homelessness as a phenomenon, and it's too difficult. but you can help a few people, you can change a few lives.
You know, most people, I think, I've seen in Europe, have never met a refugee. So you grew up among refugees and you decided to work for refugees. What was your first job in this field?
My first job with UNHCR was in Turkey. I was sent to interview asylum seekers, a bit like a machine. We had groups of asylum seekers from Iran and from Iraq brought by the Turkish police to our office in Ankara. And we had a very tiny office, and we were two officers, and we had about 20 people to interview every day. They were brought in handcuffed by the Turkish police, and we had to interview them and make a decision as to whether they were refugee or whether they were economic migrants coming looking for a better future.
So just so our listeners understand, UNHCR had the role of taking over the asylum interviews on behalf of the Turkish government.
Exactly. There are many places in the world, more than 60 countries, like where governments don't take this sort of decision, and UNHCR has to take those sort of decisions.
Okay, so the backdrop was the Iranian Revolution and many people fleeing, and you are, what, 22 or 23?
Yeah, I was 23, lacking experience, and never had been confronted to that sort of situation where people talk to you about execution, prison, torture, trying to distinguish people who had genuinely suffered human rights violation from people who had been committing human rights violation.
And these experiences as a as an officer who, you know, hears asylum cases and claims, it can be very traumatic. There's a syndrome called secondary trauma. I mean, did you feel that? What was it like when you went home at night?
When you go home at night, you think about those stories, about those, the face of the people you talk to, about their emotion. Sometimes you know you are the first person who have talked to them, who has received their stories. And sometimes the father would not talk in front of his children, the husband or the wife would not talk in presence of the other spouse and wanted to share with you their story. And so you are the recipient of a lot of horror, and you have to try to make sense of that. You understand the whole story before taking a decision, but each of those stories somehow you absorb them. And unless you have good counseling, and in those days we did not have anything like that, you just absorb, and in the middle of the night you have nightmares because you are in those Iranian jails with them.
And nevertheless, you continued this work at UNHCR.
I continue because I could see, I think, with my colleagues that we could not change anything. You know, Iran was bleeding. All sorts of people were leaving the country for good or bad reasons. You had the war with Iraq at that stage. You had Iraqis also leaving. And you realize you can't stop those wars. I mean, you have absolutely no power to stop anything like that. But, you know, this individual in front of you, you may be able to help that person. You may be able to save that person.
So you can't stop the wars, but you can help the victims.
Exactly.
And that's a driving and very compelling force.
No, absolutely. There are not that many jobs like that where you can see the impact of what you are doing.
But hearing all those horrors, I mean, how did that change your outlook towards the world and humanity?
Well, I mean, you see the dark side of the human being. You see also the resilience, the courage of people. But professionally, it's difficult because, you know, you have to be attentive to your spouse, to play with your kids. And sometimes you close. You don't talk too much about your work because what you want to share.
The contrast is
You don't want to transfer those traumas to the people you love. Mm-hmm. But but then you keep everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You spent the first part of your career listening to the horror stories of other people, but then your life, your own life, became a nightmare. In 1998, when you were working in the Caucasus in southern Russia, close to Chechnya, a region that was torn apart by a separatist insurgency, you yourself were kidnapped.
I was head of operation for the North Caucasus for the refugee agency, and this region was plagued with several conflicts. And at the same time that you had those conflicts, you had criminal elements cross-fertilizing with militant groups, and hostage-taking became a business at that time. And the few foreigners that were in the North Caucasus were humanitarian aid workers, so several got abducted. Many released against ransom, others disappeared, some were killed.
Before you were?
Yeah, before
we were. So you weren't worried that this would happen to you?
Well, we knew there were risks. We were taking all sorts of precaution in terms of security. We were, I think, quite careful. Many humanitarian aid workers had left the region. And somehow, maybe we thought we were safe. We were operating quite far from Chechnya, so we thought that we were out of reach for that sort of threat.
So what happened on that day, that fateful day?
Yeah, one day I came back late. I had a big bus coming from Moscow for some meetings, and took him out for dinner to a restaurant, brought him back to his hotel. I was not followed, but when I arrived to my flat, with my driver was also my bodyguard. I start to open the door of my flats, and some three men with mask and fully armed came down from the floor above me, and they ask us to put our hands up and get into the flat, and then they search us, they separated us. And they took me to another room, and they asked me to kneel down in front of my fridge. And there was one guy who put a gun with a silencer against my neck. And at that time, I thought it would be some sort of contract killing. I must have had antagonized a lot of people, not awarding contract. So I thought, okay, that's it. That's where it ends. And then they blindfolded me and took me downstairs and put me in a car, a trunk of cars, transferred me from cars to cars. And after 3 days, I was in Chechnya in a basement.
You were in the trunk of a car for 3 days?
Yeah. You feel you're not going to breathe. You don't feel your legs after some time because it's blood circulation was bad, you know. You smell the fume of the car. You feel every bump of the road. I try to keep some notions of the time, calculated more or less 3-4 minutes by each song that they were playing on a tape loudly in the car, and try to keep a sense of direction. The car goes left, the car goes right. We drive 200 meters here or there. So I had some idea of the direction more or less we were taking, because I'd been living in that area for more than 2 years. But then I lost a sense of direction. I kept some sense of time. I don't think I slept much over those 3 days.
It must have been absolutely frightening.
Very frightening, and we know also from training, we are a bit trained for this sort of event, but not on such a length of time. You know, 3 days in the trunk, it's not like having a sandbag on your face for 1 hour. It's a long time. And you know that as long as they have not brought you to a place of detention, this is a dangerous phase, because those guys can be stopped on the way, things can go wrong. And so you don't question order, and you just wait for the next step to take place. And then I was transferred from one group to another. Some spoke Osset, the other spoke English. And then the last group spoke Chechen. And I realized after some time I was in Chechnya.
And where did they put you?
Yeah, they put me for the first 3 days. I was in a room, reasonably well treated. I was considered to be a guest by my host. I had two guards with me all the time. Got some good food for 3 days. And after 3 days, the treatment changed. They put me to a cellar. And so I was handcuffed to a bed. I had,
you were handcuffed to a bed?
Yeah, handcuffed to a metallic cable that is tied to a bed, so that that gives me little margin of movement around the bed, on one side of the bed, but enough to make four footsteps. And you get used to that.
It was dark.
It was dark. The darkness was more difficult to cope with than limited freedom of movement. Darkness is something that is oppressive, because after some time, the brain starts creating colors, images, and weird things, weird thoughts.
So how did you work with your mind, which was going in those kinds of directions?
So I try not to think, and that's difficult for me or for anyone. Try not to think, because when you think, you don't think very positively. You think about the what if that can go wrong. So I try to keep the mind focused on physical exercise, on all sorts of memorization games, a bit of praying, a bit of translation games. Always try to keep the mind busy on something else than just thinking about what can happen.
Sibonia et au Tretti Yun, ya Vincent Cochetel, Blava Owen UVKB.
During Vincent's captivity, he was made by his captors to record several ransom demands. On these recordings, you can hear him stating the date and asking for help in Russian. The first videos you can see he's clean-shaven, but later he has a thick beard. He's in a dark room lit only by candlelight, and sometimes you can barely make him out. You were held for 317 days like that in that dark basement. You were given food, I believe, only once a day, and that was the only time you had any light, the light of a candle.
Yeah.
What do you think about when you think about a candle?
Well, I love candles. There are many candles in my place. I like candles.
So that was the 15 minutes...
15 minutes of quiet time, normally. Sometime an opportunity to engage a bit with a guard. Sometime a guard would stay with me the 15 minutes. I also used that time to share the piece of bread I was getting, so I was normally cut it in half, so I would have two meals a day. I try to save a bit for the other part of the day. Another candle was the hope of better days. I'd been doing a lot of volunteer work with Amnesty International before, and candle was our symbol, and I remember selling that on markets. And so that was something that kept that hope of life alive.
Now, these guards were your captors. You engaged with them sometimes. What kind of relationship did you have with them?
Well, with some of them, the dialogue was violent. Some of them were silent. Some of them were a bit more talkative. Soldiers of fortune, they could have worked for any criminal group, any militant group. When they would speak, normally their favorite themes were weapons, woman, car. Not much more than that. Occasionally, there was one or two guards that talk about classic French literature. Somehow in the Soviet days you could not get modern literature, but they all knew very well their classics. It was sort of interesting discussion, totally surreal, about guards talking about literature and me trying to argue something with limited Russian vocabulary, but it was still interesting encounter. But some of the guards were brutal. They were either because they were drunk, either because they were sadistic, either sometimes because they did not know how to handle me, or sometimes because I was not nice to them. There were moments where I let it go in terms of frustration or was myself aggressive with them.
What surprised you about yourself?
Well, I think first is you have to be confronted to a very difficult moment in life to find out that you have so many resources, and it's terrible to consider that you need accident in life to know that. For some people, it can be a car accident, a long illness, the loss of a close friend. Others might be an abduction in my case. But it's amazing the resource that we have and that we don't use, because we can adapt. And this is what refugees have taught me over life. People adapt. People are resilient. People can can go through very, very dark moments. But then with the hope that something better will happen. And so you can cope with violence, you can cope with the pressure, and but there is no bottom, you know. Some people set probably artificial threshold and say, I won't do this, I won't accept that. And if you set artificial threshold, I think you don't survive.
Vincent was rescued in a gun battle between his captors and Russian special forces, who filmed the entire operation. It took just 5 minutes, but for Vincent, it felt like an eternity.
I was woken up in the morning by the group holding me, blindfolded me, handcuffed me in the back, taken to a car, blindfold removed, put back, transferred from different car, driving in a convoy of brand new four-wheel drive car, 3 o'clock in the morning, heavily armed guards all around me, and there's not much talking in the car, and I'm handed over to a last group, small white Jeep. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, that I will know after. And there they blindfold me again. They put me in the middle of the back seat. That car drives in a no man's land off-road. And all of a sudden, it's like in a bad movie. They're shooting outside, windows being smashed. One body falling on me on my left-hand side, and emptiness on the right-hand side. I feel the air outside. The door is open. So I just dive, fall on the ground, take cover. Under the back, the rear tire of the car. Are they shooting around? I'm hearing, where is the hostage? Where is the hostage? And after some time, I say, I'm here. And someone pulled me, asked me to kneel down. And I don't know whether these are the hostage keepers. Is it another group stealing me? And all of a sudden, I'm carried by two. They ask me to walk. I can't walk. I don't feel my legs. I think I'm trembling. And there are two guys, they pull me and drag me about 200-300 meters, throw me into another car. And there I hurt with my head a helmet that was on the floor of the car. And there I know that I'm with the Russian force, because the Chechens don't wear helmets. And the car drives, and we go to undercover operational center of special Russian forces.
Voici le titre que nous allons développer dans ce journal, la libération de Vincent Cochetel, qui devrait arriver dans moins d'une demi-heure à Genève. Fin du cauchemar pour l'ex-otage français, document exceptionnel sur l'opération qui a permis sa libération.
Сегодня сотрудники МВД доставили Винсана Коштеля в Москву. Операция длилась.
Vincent's rescue and his return home made global news. TV channels showed him thin and pale, falling into the arms of his family. French television broadcast Vincent's first phone call to his family after 11 long months.
Que toute la famille attend.
Allô, Vincent.
Oh là là, qu'est-ce qu'on est content d'entendre ta voix, tu sais.
You came back extremely thin and probably traumatized, but you decided that you wanted to return to the work that you were previously doing for UNHCR and serve refugees. Why?
Many colleagues say, you have enough, you know, why don't you do something else? Not my family, but colleagues. Why don't you do something else? You know, people will understand, you're still young, you can do something else. And I say, well, no, if I stop now, that means my kidnappers would have won. They would have taken my soul, my humanity, my purpose in life. So I'm not going to stop now. I'm going to turn that into something that is meaningful and that makes sense.
So you work, again, very closely with refugees in senior management positions. You were also heading our Washington office for some time. You were leading the Bureau for Europe. Now you are working as special envoy for UNHCR for the Central Mediterranean situation. People are still fleeing the wars that are not being prevented or stopped, and others are leaving because of very compelling economic reasons, including some of the drivers caused by climate change. They arrive in a place like Libya, and some of them get stuck. Some of them are held for many, many months. Some of them have actually been kidnapped. You've gone to Libya. You've gone to those detention centers. You've met the migrants and the refugees who are being held there. As somebody who himself was kidnapped, how does it make you feel to hear those stories now?
84% of the people in detention have told us that they have experienced some form of torture. 73% of the people have witnessed killing in front of them in those detention centers. I have not spoken to one woman who has not been raped, not one, in those Libyan detention centers. I met recently with a young man, and you know, you try to avoid the question, how are you today, because you see where they live. You can ask, how is the food? But the answer to that question can be dangerous. If they are not fed and they complain about the food, then the guards can retaliate against them. So one guy was really silent and say, well, I can't talk to you. And discreetly, he removed his shirt to show marks of torture on his body. I don't know who had inflicted those marks on his body, but the person had suffered a lot, and you could see that. And there was no way that person could communicate. He was only communicating through his body language. And you leave that place and you say, what you have achieved today? Well, we can bring some blankets, we can bring a bit of food, but we are not changing the dynamics of those places. So it's constant ethical dilemma. So we are criticized sometimes, say, why do you go to those detention centers? By going there, maybe you give encouragement to the system to continue that. But as humanitarian, our basic principle is do not harm. And, you know, at least bringing a bit of medicine, bringing a bit of food and all that is better than ignoring them. Because by going there, we still witness of their suffering. And maybe by testifying on what's happening to them, we'll be able to change some of the politics around that.
And that's your job now. You deliver the messages, the stories, you describe what you've seen to policymakers and politicians in Europe and around the world.
Yes.
Is that changing things?
Well, sometimes they want to hear, but sometimes they want simplification. I remember once discussing with an official that got very upset with me. I said, you know, I saw a woman today and she looked like my mother. And I would not like my mother to be in that situation. And I would not like your mother to be in that situation. And I don't know whether there was something about his mother that I did not know, but the guy got, you can't compare those women to my mother. And I said, I'm not comparing human beings. I just said it's not human to be in this sort of situation. But you try sometime to look for what is going to be the argument that works with some of them. I can't believe that they don't have any sense of humanity. Those people have families. When they go back to their kids, what do they tell about their job? I believe there must be a little spark of conscience somewhere, and we have to try to find it. We have to try to use it to turn things around.
What keeps you up at night?
The people we did not save. Those we left behind in difficult circumstances, and that are gone today. And we did not take the right decision, or the circumstances, the security environment did not enable us to go and save them. But they have faces, they have histories. These are people you've met, and you live with them.
You have dedicated your life in so many ways to helping refugees. And, you know, I know many people around the world who are doing other jobs that are not in the humanitarian field still want to do something to help. What do you suggest to people when they ask you, how can I help?
Well, you don't need necessarily to help just refugees. Look around your neighborhood. There are many people that need help. And charity starts at home sometimes. But I would say volunteer. There are many causes that requires volunteers, and we need to take care of also the refugees in our societies, make sure that they feel welcome, and make sure that we give them a chance to start a new life. And they will stay with us for a number of years, or they will return back home. But we need to make sure that we give them what they have lost to some extent.
Vincent, thank you very much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Awake at Night. Find out more about the series and see pictures of Vincent at work by visiting unhcr.org/awakeatnight. Find us on Facebook at UNHCR, and on Twitter we're at Refugees, and I'm at Melissa R. Fleming. You can also follow Vincent at Koshtel. Please spread the word about the series using hashtag Awake at Night. Thanks to Alex Court and the fantastic design and studio teams here at UNHCR, and to my producers, Bethany Bell, and also Laura Sheeter of Chalk and Blade. The original music for this podcast was written and performed by Nadine Shaw and produced by Ben Hillier. Nadine's latest album, Holiday Destination, is inspired by the Syrian refugee crisis, and it's incredible. It has been nominated for the prestigious Mercury Music Prize in the UK. My guest next week will be telling me about facing the destruction of her childhood home city in Nigeria by Boko Haram militants.